Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the podcast. Last year, I got a really cool gift. It was a book titled The Whisper on the Night Wind by author Adam Schultz. I had previously read Schultz's book, Alone Against the North, and loved how he seamlessly blended a first-person adventure narrative with history, geography, and local folklore. But The Whisper on the Night Wind was different. Schultz was solving a bit of a mystery. What was the creature of Traverse Spine? Traverse Spine was a small village in Labrador, which was a fur trading post in the early 20th century, but it's now a ghost town. To this day, you'd be hard-pressed to find it on a map. I'd never heard of Traverse Spine, but immediately upon reading about it, it reminded me of Portlock, Alaska, which I covered in a Halloween special in 2021. The story goes, in Traverse Spine, local wildlife biologists and trappers reported finding strange tracks in the woods. Sled dogs went missing, and children reported seeing a large animal-like creature appear in and around the edge of the village, lurking amongst the trees. But nobody could identify what it was. A gorilla? Some type of bear? A demon? A yeti or some skinwalker-type witch? Adam Schultz took off into the remote, rugged, and occupied wilderness of Labrador with a companion to try and unearth what haunted and stalked the town of Traverse Spine. He hoped to unravel the mystery once and for all, and what he experienced was incredible, educational, and downright hair-tingling. Enjoy my chat with Adam.
A lot of monikers that I'll mention off the top in my scripted voiceover, but like, you know, you've got a PhD, you've written 4 best-selling books, you know, you've been dubbed Canada's Indiana Jones. Like, how did this journey start for you, and like, were you always an explorer and this passionate writer at heart?
Well, not necessarily, no. When I was a kid, all I wanted to do was spend time in the woods. And if you said, like, do you want to be an explorer? I probably would barely have even known what that meant. There wasn't Dora the Explorer yet. That was a little after my time. So as a kid, I just thought of myself, actually, the term I would have used the most was actually woodsman. That's kind of what was in my imagination as a 10-year-old in the forest. I was just sort of, I want to survive in the forest and learn how to live off the land and what mushrooms are safe to eat, which ones are poisonous. How do you make fire without matches? How do you make a shelter, catch fish, sleep under the stars, build canoes and paddle them? I was just trying to live in the forest. That was my passion. That's what I loved. I loved wild animals. I loved trees, all these sorts of things. And I was really lucky. You know, I grew up in rural Canada, so I had a forest right in my backyard. Like, literally, I walked out the back door, or the front door for that matter. There was forest in either direction. And I could go out in the woods and play to my heart's content. And my parents let me do that. My brother and I were always out in the forest. We used to build canoes with my father and paddle them around on the local rivers and creeks. So when I was a kid, that's what I did. And everything else came later in terms of doing expeditions professionally and writing books.
Yeah. And I mean, there's kind of a, I guess, a little bit of a stereotype. I mean, I have a master's degree, not a PhD, but, you know, when, you know, you, there is a bit of a stereotype that, you know, academics who write books tend to be kind of boring. And you are kind of the antithesis of that. Like, all of your books are these super riveting adventures mixed with this really rich folklore and history and indigenous culture. Like, there's so much in them. And I'm just wondering, like, when you were in academia, like, was there an aha moment when you were like, hey, I can take, you know, my interests, what I'm studying, and blend it all into this kind of adventure historical narrative? Or, like, how did that come about for you?
Well, I never even really reflect on that. I'm just lucky that it all came together some way or another. I was always just sort of pursuing my own love of adventure and the outdoors, and all the stars sort of aligned. I think when I was a teenager, that's when I started, you know, 18, 19, when I started to think more about how do I monetize my interests and my hobbies. You know, I'm passionate about adventures and the wilderness, and that's what I want to make the basis of my life. I want to do these adventures, but how can I earn a living? So I started to think, like, well, maybe I'll become a park ranger. And I remember in Ontario, anyways, in the 10th grade, you have a mandatory career studies class where you have to choose a career. And I chose park ranger as what I wanted to do with my life, because I just knew I want to be outside. I want to be in the wilderness. That's how I want to make my living. And that was kind of where I was thinking when I was a teenager. And I even had a summer job working for the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources as a ranger. But I was always interested in history. I mean, I loved reading books. Every chance I got, I was into Canadian history, folklore, voyageurs, indigenous cultures. I loved all that stuff. I loved legends, myths. So I was a bookworm as well. And spending a lot of time alone in the wilderness really lent itself to being a bookworm. The two went together. So I thought, well, maybe that wouldn't satisfy me. What else could I do to earn a living, you know, living in the forest? I thought, well, maybe I could become a wildlife biologist. But then when I looked at, you know, wildlife biology, I thought it was a little too dry, maybe not really my interest. So I didn't know. And my dream, I guess, by the time I was like 20, 21 was, well, I guess the ultimate dream would be if you could just make your living writing books about adventures and the outdoors and in history and nature. But I didn't know whether or not I'd ever actually be able to do that. So I just sort of kept doing my adventures, expeditions, piecemeal, always on a shoestring budget, doing a little bit of freelance writing here and there. Sometimes I would do a slideshow at like a local library or school if people wanted to see the kind of adventures and wildlife I was photographing. But, you know, I was just sort of scraping by until about 29. That's when my first book was published, and I really didn't think anyone would read it. I thought if it sold 500 copies, that would be like, wow, the height of my ambition. I couldn't possibly dream more than that. But I suppose I was lucky that the book somehow pretty much organically reached an audience, and people seemed to like it, or at least some people. And that has been my profession ever since, basically doing adventures and expeditions and through storytelling, earning my living from them.
That's incredible. And your expeditions are epic. You mentioned that first book, which I read, and I'm assuming you're referring to Alone Against the North, which is a riveting read. Like, how do you map out, or like, how do you look at something and go, like, this is an expedition that I can not only do, but write about? Like, is there criteria? Like, how do you go about planning something like that?
Well, I do so many projects and so many adventures and expeditions that the vast majority I don't actually publicize in any way. They'll never really see the light of day. I don't write about them. I take GoPro footage and other footage on those expeditions, but then it literally just sits on like a USB drive or a hard drive at my house, and I never edit it or do anything with it. I have expeditions going back 10 years, and I'm like, oh, yeah, if I get a free time, maybe on a Saturday I'll pull out that expedition that I did where I went across the Northwest Territories, or that one where I was searching for rattlesnakes, and edit all that and maybe share it on YouTube. But I just never really have free time because I'm always coming up with new adventure ideas. Like just last night, I had my little notebook because I like to do things old fashioned with a pen and paper rather than on the computer. And I was writing out my expedition ideas for the 2020s for this upcoming decade. And I had like 30 or 40 of them. And I get so excited just planning and thinking ahead to new adventures that it sometimes makes it difficult to come back to actually like sitting down and saying, okay, well, the last 15 expeditions I did, which one's the most interesting, the most exciting that I can maybe write a book about? So I've done all kinds of ones. Like last year I was out in the Rockies. I was retracing David Thompson's route through the Rockies, and I was searching for a lake that he had described secondhand in one of his journals, but had never actually laid eyes on the summit of a mountain that was connected to a legend. So I did this whole expedition to go find this lake, and I found it. But, you know, 15 months later, I still haven't actually done anything with that. It's just the material is sitting there. I'm very lucky in that I have a position at the Royal Canadian Geographical Society, so I'll write reports for them, but nobody ever actually reads them, really. They just kind of go on file in Ottawa. And I did, as I mentioned, an expedition on rattlesnakes. I did expeditions on migratory birds, on looking for lost explorers, on archaeological sites, on the whole range, everything I ever dreamed of since I was a kid, you know, all the stuff I filled my head with, my imagination. Now I'm actually lucky enough that I'm getting to live these dreams. But if I do a really big journey, or if there's something that I find really, you know, burning fascination, I can't get this out of the back of my mind, those are the ones that I might gravitate towards. So, you know, I really want to write about this and turn it into a book. So those relatively few expeditions that I've done have been turned into books. I've only really written three books that are about my expeditions. And then I have a fourth book, but that's not about anything I did. That's about historical expeditions from people like Alexander Mackenzie, Samuel Hearn, Samuel Duchamp-Plain. So that's kind of how things go. I guess, like a lot of other fields, I have basically a pool, and I narrow that pool of applicants down to maybe the three or four best ones that I've got for a book.
And your latest book, The Whisper on the Night Wind, which I was just saying to you before we started that I finished a couple nights ago, like, it focuses around this really mythological place that I'd never heard of, Traverse Spine. And I'm wondering, like, before we get into what is or was Traverse Spine, like, how did you, A, find out about this place, and then B, again, because of your all of your adventures, pick this as your next book project?
Well, I mean, as I've already said, I had an intense interest from the youngest age in wilderness, in Canadian wilderness. I mean, that was the air I breathed. That was my daily bread. 7 days a week, I was obsessed with anything to do with wilderness, from wild mushrooms to folklore to history to survival to canoeing. And I think anyone who's interested in that, inevitably, sooner or later, is going to come across campfire stories, legends of things that go bump in the night, of large tracks found in some lonely backwoods pass up in the mountains that no one can explain. You know, stories of Sasquatch, Wendigos, Bigfoot, this sort of thing. And ever since I was a kid, there was a part of my imagination that was absolutely enthralled and fascinated by that. You know, who isn't, to a certain extent, thrilled by these kind of mysteries of the wild? And what really intrigued me as I got a little bit older, as I started to get more into Canadian history, is that, well, you know, a lot of these stories weren't just pop culture phenomenons of mass media of the late 20th century, that some of them had roots going back centuries. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting that you can read diaries or explorers' journals from 200 years ago, 300 years ago, and they're describing these same sorts of encounters with unknown creatures, legends, Sasquatch, this sort of thing. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. You know, if these are just legends, why do they have such staying power? And how do we explain them? So I became very intrigued by it. And it was always sort of in the background of what I was doing, you know, in Beyond the Trees and Alone Against the North. And even in my book, A History of Canada in 10 Maps, I would find some way somewhere in the book to work in references to, well, cryptozoology or legends or folklore. Because I thought, you know, this really gives color to the history. It helps bring it to life and gives us a new perspective on what it was actually like in 1811 to be David Thompson on snowshoes going through the Athabasca Pass, where it is essentially a place where anything is possible. It's the closest thing that we can get to, you know, going to another planet where you might encounter some crazy, fantastic species that you don't know anything about. You know, to David Thompson in 1811, it was entirely plausible that around the next bend in the river, there might be woolly mammoths or mastodons on the riverbank. So I love talking about this sort of thing in my history books and in my adventure books. And I mean, as you sort of alluded to earlier, in academia, it always astonished me that no one else really wanted to do that. I'd be like, how is it possible that there's been all these academic books written on David Thompson and this aspect of his diaries is almost entirely ignored or overlooked as if it's not really worthy of a serious attention? I'm like, you know, this is the most exciting part in some ways of his diary. So I was always interested in that. But on the other hand, I was like, you know, many of these subjects nowadays in the 21st century, they've been done to death in terms of documentaries, TV shows, books, magazine articles, you name it. The subjects have been exhausted. They've been investigated from every possible perspective, especially Sasquatch or Bigfoot, for lack of a better term. So I had done a lot of original research in the archives on the fur trade, and I had uncovered a lot of records from the 1700s, 1800s on those subjects, or at least on the prototypes of them from a couple hundred years ago. But I never really thought I would ever publish or write anything about it, just because it seemed to me like the subject had been covered so heavily. But then I came across one that was unlike anything I'd ever seen before, and from the exact opposite end of the country, not from British Columbia or the Rocky Mountains, but from Labrador, of all places. And I mean, Labrador is such a remote and isolated place that I don't even think it crosses most people's minds ever. Like, it's tucked away at the end of the continent up in the Northeast there, as lonely a land as you could wish for. And this story that I found from Labrador, it was in a trapper's diary from 100 years ago. It immediately sent chills down my spine. He talked about encountering some kind of large animal that no one could identify, not even fur trappers who spent their lifetimes in the wilderness. But there was something about the account that had, I don't want to go so far as to say the ring of truth about it, but there was something concrete, something real about it that often seemed to be lacking in other accounts that I would come across, where you could say, well, you know, it's very circumstantial or very, very second or third hand or easily dismissed. But this one was different. It had all sorts of fascinating details in it about, you know, dogs that went missing in the night, or strange tracks, or the apparent targeting of children, which made it even creepier than it might otherwise have been. And I guess, moreover, is that the account wasn't well known at all. Like, you know, it was basically had not really been written about at all. It was like, there's nothing on Wikipedia. Like, it doesn't really exist in modern pop culture to any extent at all. So I was like, you know, this is something new that hasn't been done before. And I think it's a story at the end of the day that's fascinating, that people would like to hear about. So maybe I'll try to bring it to a wider audience, wider attention, and try to really delve into this, jump into it with 2 feet, dig through the historical records, actually do an expedition to Labrador to try to see if there's anything more there, do more research, and bring this story to life, like a detective story of an old cold case that's been sitting forgotten in some archive in a basement for 50 years and it hasn't been touched, just collecting dust. So I'm going to blow the dust off these files and try to tell this really interesting mystery from the heart of the Canadian wilderness from 100 years ago and what it might have been. So that's kind of how it began and how I ended up writing a book that is a little bit different than any of my other books. I mean, it's still a wilderness adventure. It's still about exploration, but it really goes deep into the folklore, the mythology, cryptozoology, and all those subjects.
Yeah, it really does. And like I said, because there's so many multifacets to the way and the subjects that you cover in the book, it makes it riveting and so engaging. Before we get into your, and obviously I don't want to spoil too much of the book because I want people to go read it because it's incredible. But before we get into your journey, from my understanding and what I read in the book, like, Traverse Spine was like this really, like, relatively small, isolated village. And then kind of like Portlock, Alaska, which was another village in Alaska that I covered in another podcast. These strange happenings, like you kind of alluded to earlier, start to occur in the community. Some pretty horrific stuff starts to happen. And people start seeing what I guess, for lack of a better term, this kind of like beast creature lurking around this village. Can you give me some context on, you know, what was Traverse Spine like? When did it exist? You know, who would have lived there? And then, you know, maybe we can get into then the mythology surrounding this so-called beast that may have inhabited the area.
Right. So absolutely. So all of the sightings that I uncovered in the historical record are from just one little corner of Labrador. And Labrador is a vast place. I mean, it covers almost 300,000 square kilometers. So you're talking about an immense area of mountains, fjords, tundra, and forest. But all of the encounters that I could find were clustered around just one little place called Traverse Pine. Now, if you look up Traverse Pine on a map today, you won't find it. It's not on any modern map, but 100 years ago, it was a little tiny community in Labrador. In fact, by Labrador standards, it was kind of a thriving metropolis. It had four houses at its height, which is a lot for Labrador. It had been founded around the year 1840, like most towns in Canada, as a fur trade post. It was started by the Hudson's Bay Company. The Hudson's Bay Company, at their height in the 1800s, they operated literally hundreds of fur trade posts all across Canada, from Vancouver Island to Labrador. But this place was so isolated and so remote, even by the standards of a fur trade post, that it wasn't long before the Hudson's Bay Company actually shut it down. They said it's just not profitable. It's so remote. Hardly any fur trappers ever actually show up here to trade furs. So they shut it down and closed it. And actually a local French-Canadian trapper took it over and tried to keep it going as an independent fur trade post. And it did sort of survive and keep going, but it was always going to be one of those remote, far flung.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Off the beaten track locations. And that's what they were doing when these sightings took place all around the area. And what made it more intriguing and sort of marked it out as different than the folklore around, say, Sasquatch, is that the sightings seem to be based around just a series of incidents, something with like a very definitive start and end, where over a period of just, you know, several years or winters, people in the area, fur trappers and their families, kept describing seeing some sort of creature. Some sort of creature that was unlike anything they'd seen before. Sometimes it walked on two legs. Sometimes it dropped to all fours. Sometimes they said there was two of them, a larger one and a smaller one. But just these creatures, which they described variously as a demon or a devil, which I also thought was interesting that there was sort of a supernatural element to the story in that they specifically referenced it as a demon. Now, the other thing that was intriguing about it and made it totally unlike any sort of Sasquatch account is they described the tracks in great detail and even recorded patterns of the tracks by basically putting paper on the ground over the sand or the snow or the mud and tracing them out. And the track was about 12 inches long, but here's where it gets really interesting. It was narrow at the heel. So narrow at the heel, almost like what you would think of as like a dinosaur track, like a T-Rex or a Velociraptor. And at the front, forked into only two toes. So just two toes. So not at all like a like an ape or a primate track, right? So something very weird going on here. And there were other details they recorded. They said, you know, they set bear traps for this creature, whatever it was, or creatures if it was indeed plural. And they would put like bait in the traps, meat or fish, but the creatures would never go near them. Instead, it would root up rotten logs or rip the bark off trees. Their sled dogs, they said, would encounter them in the night, and the sled dogs were terrified. They would get driven into the river, try to escape. So you can picture like a full-grown husky or a team of huskies actually jumping into a river in Labrador and trying to swim away from whatever this thing was that they were so scared of. So there were a lot of really creepy, terrifying details in the accounts, which, again, is quite different than a lot of Sasquatch accounts where, you know, the creature is described as relatively benign. And of course, there are exceptions to that. But many of them are just like, yeah, I saw like a 8-foot primate run across the road and disappear. But all of these extra details, which were kind of alarming, gave this account a unique feel. But yeah, really, really fascinated me. And the other thing that was interesting is the accounts were very detailed. They weren't like many other cryptozoology accounts where it's very vague, or the person who's recording them is sort of a dubious character who you have to take with a very big grain of salt. These ones were made by medical doctors who wander Labrador's wilderness, providing medical care and antibiotics to those isolated fur trappers and their families. So these were people who were well-educated. They were trained in the scientific method to be careful observers and to write down detailed accounts of what they saw and diagnose them. And none of these people ever expressed any skepticism. They never said, you know, this is a hoax or this is a case of isolation going to people's heads and they're hallucinating. No, they all accepted that there was something real, something in the physical world or in the material world that had emerged there and come out of the wilderness to terrorize this place. Another one of the accounts that had been made was by a wildlife biologist. So someone actually trained to identify wild animals. That wildlife biologist, he tried to come up with some sort of explanation for what he thought it was, which just added to the mystery of it. But much like the others, he was convinced that this was no hoax and that a real creature had actually emerged there and had been seen. So there was just many elements, many layers to this mystery that made it absolutely fascinating. And I was determined to research it and write a book about it.
I don't want to go too deep into all the mythology because, again, I want people to read the book and not spoil it. But when you talk about these accounts, you know, are these mostly sightings or are they more menacing? Like, are people going missing from this village or people showing up dead? Like, what's the, I guess, the most, you know, macabre kind of outcome of this creature being around this village?
No human fatalities that were recorded, at least none that I ever uncovered. And I think you can say that with a high degree of confidence, because that would be the sort of thing you would definitely want to write down in your journal. But sled dogs, huskies going missing in the night. So that would be the most gruesome, is that, well, apparently there were unexplained disappearances of the dogs, the sled dogs. And in Labrador, I mean, you have to remember, this is over a century ago. So your sled dogs are absolutely vital, right? There's no cars, there's no snowmobiles, there's no motorboats. And in a place where snow cover lasts from October to May, your huskies are the most important thing you own, the most valuable. So to have your dogs disappear in the night is very serious, right? Like that is extremely serious and alarming. Now, the other thing is that one pattern that did emerge in the accounts is that children did seem to be an especial object of interest to these creatures. Again and again in the accounts, there was an apparent targeting of children, that it would often be a child, a young girl or any young child alone outside the cabin or outside the homestead who would encounter these creatures, whatever they were. And one of the more disturbing aspects of the story, which again made it quite different than any Sasquatch story, or at least the majority of them, is that they said that in one of them, the creature actually beckoned to a child. That was the term used, beckoned, as if, you know, it motioned for it to come near. So quite creepy stuff. And also, yes, a definite element of menace, that, you know, this is not friendly or benign. There's definitely something disturbing going on here. And that was the opinion of the people who actually lived there at the time. As I said, they used the word demon to refer to the creatures. So they, you know, they definitely saw it as something that had hostile intentions, something that meant to do them harm. So that was about as gruesome as it got. And there were other suggestions. One of the more interesting details is they said that whatever the creatures were, they actually devoured seal bones whole. Which they took to mean, you know, this, whatever this thing is, it's very large and it's got very powerful jaws because it's eating seal bones.
Yeah. I mean, that is gruesome and incredibly scary. And here you are doing this research, reading these journal and diary entries, and then you're like, I'm going to go look for this creature. And you plan an expedition to go into the remote wilderness of Labrador. And you ended up bringing a companion who, from what I remember, you'd known at one point, but weren't that close with when you went left for the expedition. There was elements to the book that I actually found myself laughing quite a bit, because it was a bit like a buddy comedy at times, just the dynamic between you and Zach. And I'm wondering, like, how did that come about? Because it seems like you maybe prefer to do these things on your own, but you ended up taking someone with you this time around.
Yes, I mean, I'm definitely best known for doing my journeys alone. I mean, a few years ago, I did a journey alone across Canada's Arctic, which was 4,000 kilometers, and it took 4 months. So that's a lot of solitude for anyone. And I just finished this past summer another solo journey where I canoed from southern Canada on Lake Erie up to the Arctic. And I've done a whole ton of other solo journeys. I mean, one of my books even has, well, actually two of my books have alone in the title. So it's unusual for me to actually recruit a partner and say, you know, I want someone to come with me on this expedition. But for this one, there were a couple of circumstances that led me in that direction. The first was just the time. You know, it was almost the end of the summer, pretty much the 1st of September by the time I was going to launch the expedition. And at those latitudes in Labrador, the rivers are going to start to freeze up by October. So it doesn't leave a whole lot of time to mount an expedition and carry it out. And I thought, you know, if you have a second person in the canoe, two people can paddle twice as fast, cover twice the ground. So simply from a practical perspective, having two people is an advantage. You can cover more distance. You can do twice as much. And second of all, because of the unique element of this expedition, where it wasn't going to simply be a journey from point A to point B, or it wasn't just going to be about mapping some river, but it was actually a mystery that we were investigating. I thought, you know, two heads are better than one. Having a second pair of eyes, a second perspective, is definitely going to be valuable. So I wanted to find someone to come with me, but I had a relatively small window of opportunity, a short amount of time to do so. So kind of naturally, I just looked among people I already knew rather than, you know, trying to find someone over the internet or something like that. And I'm from a small town. I looked in my high school yearbook, said, is there anyone I went to high school with who might have a sudden impulse to want to drop everything and set off to Labrador? And I saw this one guy, his name's Zach, and I was like, yeah, that guy, he would probably be the one to do it. Didn't really know him that well in school. He was a year ahead of me, and I'd never been camping with him before, but I reached out to him, told him, this is what I have in mind, this is what I want to do, I have to be ready to leave by like Tuesday morning, are you okay with this? Fortunately, he was, and he came with me, and he actually turned out to be like an ideal partner. I couldn't say a bad word about him. And he proved very valuable in helping shed light onto this mystery. He had some really good theories about what he thought was going on there 100 years ago. So yeah, he came with me and helped me on that expedition a great deal.
Yeah, and it seems like the terrain and just the topography, the geography of Labrador. I mean, I've been to Newfoundland, but in the more populated areas. And I mean, I know all of your journeys are difficult in harsh terrain, but I mean, was there anything unique, you know, about going into the Labrador wilderness? And like, was there anything you didn't expect? I mean, you've been on so many of these adventures. Were there challenges or something maybe you didn't anticipate coming across?
Well, the area of Labrador that we went to specifically is called the Muley Mountains. And the Muley Mountains are no ordinary mountain range. They're ancient almost beyond human conception. I mean, if you think of the Rocky Mountains, they're like less than 100 million years old. Well, the Muley Mountains are like 3 billion years old, or even more than 3 billion years old. So to the human mind, like, we can barely wrap our heads around such an ancient number. And the terrain around them is almost impenetrable. It's all alder thickets, which are like claustrophobic. You can't see more than a few feet in any direction. If you're going to try to use a GPS or a compass, you're just going to trip over deadfall and tree roots every 2 feet. So the only way to navigate practically is by the sun. And it's just very difficult. Like, 1 kilometer of hiking there is like 20 kilometers on a trail. There's no trails, no paths of any kind. So it makes the area seem extremely inaccessible. Almost like the perfect place for something to remain hidden from the modern world or for a mystery to flourish. So yeah, it's definitely a fascinating landscape. It's an ancient landscape. It's a landscape that's rich in folklore, that has bred mysteries for thousands of years since the time of the Vikings, from the Inuit, from the Dene, from the Innu. So yes, it is absolutely a unique fascinating place, even by the standards of Canada's wilderness.
There are a lot of anecdotes and accounts in the book of, I think, both you and Zach. I think it's fair to say being a little freaky out at times. You know, you're in the middle of nowhere, literally. There's just the two of you. You're often camping in not such ideal spots, like you said, in between these thickets or in these thickets along a river that you've been paddling on for most of the day. There was quite a few instances in the book that I was like, I can feel the fear and the tension, you know, and visualize myself being alone in a tent, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the dark with maybe this creature lurking about. But I'm wondering, for you, was there, a time when you were most scared or freaked out, to the point where you maybe even still think about it today? Because I just can't imagine that you're sitting in this tent, reading about all this creepy folklore, and you're not maybe feeling a little apprehensive or even scared.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the scariest part of that adventure was not actually anything that happened out in the wilderness, but something that happened afterwards when I looked through some of our motion-activated footage. Now, I don't want to spoil the book, because I tried to write the book in a way that would make it fun for readers to read and make it a sort of a thriller, a page turner, or a game of Clue, where you're trying to unravel the mystery before you get to the last chapter. So I can't give too much away in terms of what actually happened. But yeah, I mean, the Labrador landscape is quite different than other places in Canada's wild, and there's definitely something about it that seems a little bit otherworldly, a little bit spooky. You just have these windswept ancient boulders. And the forest, as I said, is very thick. I mean, it's shadowy. It's almost impenetrable in places. I mean, there's forests in Canada and British Columbia, in Ontario and Quebec that you go to, and they look like a fairy tale. Like, they're just beautiful. And it feels incredibly serene. And it's like, I just want to lie under a tree here and take a nap and soak in the majesty of this place. But Labrador is not really like that. It's more like, wow, this place is kind of like a nightmare. I mean, this is really difficult to get through. This is really rough terrain, rough country, very rugged and foreboding. So it is quite different in terms of the atmosphere of the place.
And I out of all your adventures, like, I feel like there's a lot of risk. Obviously, you know what you're doing and you know what you're getting into before you go, but has there ever been a point, and you know, in one of these expeditions where you're like, I think I gotta call it here for whatever reason? I mean, maybe it's too dangerous, too unsafe. Like, I'm just curious, like, how do you manage that when you're, especially when you're alone and you're doing these things? Like, are you, you don't seem like the reckless type. So I'm wondering, like, how do you calculate that risk versus reward on these expeditions?
Yeah, I mean, I do all these journeys that are like thousands of kilometers long solo in the wilderness, but I really don't think of myself as a daredevil or an adrenaline junkie. Quite the opposite. I don't like taking any unnecessary risks, and maybe that's the secret to success, is that I'm always trying to err on the side of caution, always trying to think, like, what's the next step? What am I going to do here? You know, analyzing this river, what's going to happen up there in those whitewater rapids? I think I can run this part, but on the left side there's a big ledge, there's a whirlpool, there's an eddy. So I don't want to gamble here. I think I'm going to take the long way around. I'm going to portage, or I'm going to actually use my rope and line the canoe where I'm going to climb on the rocks and put the canoe down in the water. So I'm always trying to be cautious, think things through. And I think that's the key on any of these kind of expeditions in remote places, especially if you're going alone or even if you're just going with one other person. Many people would say that that's actually already a high risk. There's a sort of school of thought among wilderness travelers that says, you know, you really should have a group of at least 6 people or 8 people to be perfectly safe so you can handle any contingency. A lot of people would say, you know, if you have only one canoe, that's really not much better off, because if your canoe is destroyed, something happens to it, if it gets trapped in a current or rapids, gets over a waterfall, you're stranded. You know, you've lost everything that was in that canoe. But I try to be careful, and I always say, like, if you think things through, you should be able to get out of almost any scenario. Like, most bad things happen because people are being reckless or impatient. So I try to be careful, try to plan out my next move before it happens. And I always use the mantra, slow and steady wins the race, right? That's what I tell myself all the time when I'm out in the wild, right? Don't be too hasty. Let's take it slow. Think this out. Everything will be fine, right? You gotta visualize where you put each step because if you take one wrong step and that boulder comes down the cliff and pins you, that could be very bad, very quick, or anything of that sort, right? I mean, I remember one time I was just on a solo canoe trip in Ontario, and I almost put my foot down right in a bee nest that was like in the ground. And I'm like, wow, that would have been really bad in the middle of nowhere. No one knows where I am if I had done that. But that's why I say you look where you put your foot down every single time. So I saw the bee nest and just walked around it and perfectly fine, right? No danger. You just take your time like that. So that was kind of my mentality on all of these adventures.
Yeah, very methodical, and it makes sense given these grandiose adventures that you're doing. Well, I just want to say, like, Adam, thank you for doing this with me. This was definitely a treat. Like I said, I've read two of your books, and I want to read the other two. And I'm enthralled by who you are as a person and what you write about in your adventures. So I'm looking forward to reading your next book when it comes out. And maybe if there's another mystery to unravel one day, we can have you back on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
His book, The Whisper on the Night Wind, is a gripping read. And if you like adventure narratives mixed with history, local folklore, and hints of the unknown, I highly encourage you to check out his book. You can find it online on Amazon or at your local bookstore. If you enjoyed this episode and want to show appreciation, you can buy me a coffee at the link in the description. If you want to support the podcast monthly, you can head over to my Patreon. There's also a link in the description. For $5 a month, you get ad and sponsor-free episodes, exclusive content, and early access to all new episodes of the podcast. I'll also post monthly updates on what's to come, so you know what I have in the works and what to expect. Thanks for listening to the Missing and Unexplained podcast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.